Okay, if we look at the topic of war, it would seem that a Christian could have good reason for never going to war. So for the first 300 years of the church's existence, Christians couldn't join any army at all, because to join the Roman army you had to sign an oath to the gods, and you had to swear an oath to Caesar, who was treated as a god, and Christians couldn't do that. So for most of the early years of the church, Christians weren't in any armed forces at all. And also during that time, Christians might have had very good reasons for not wanting to join the army apart from these oaths. So if you think about some of the things that Jesus said and some of the things that Jesus did, Jesus said, if someone strikes you in the right cheek, turn to him the other also. That means, basically, you don't practice an eye for an eye anymore. There was a rule in justice in the Old Testament which said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And that meant if somebody pokes you in one eye, you can poke them in one eye back. If somebody knocks out one of your teeth, you can knock one of their teeth out back. Now, that wasn't telling everybody to go around knocking people's teeth out. It was a rule for judges. It wasn't a rule for the person on the street. And the idea basically is, listen, you can't kill somebody just because they insult you. You can't kill somebody just because they can knock one of your teeth out. That rule was meant to limit the amount of punishment that people gave. If a criminal knocks somebody's tooth out, well, only punish them for that. Only have one of their teeth knocked out or something like that. Fine them if you have to. But you can't kill people just because they break the law. The punishment has to fit the crime. That's what the Old Testament rule of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth means. The punishment must fit the crime. You must not go seeking revenge. If you consider any of the action films that you watch, if the hero gets insulted in a bar, he beats the living daylights out of the guy who insulted him. You know, he completely annihilates him in a fight. That's not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So the idea is that you limit punishment. If America has the Twin Towers destroyed, they don't get to wipe out an entire nation in response. The punishment should fit the crime. But Jesus tells his followers not, listen, limit it to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, lads. What Jesus said is, if somebody strikes you in one cheek, turn the other cheek. Let them hit you again. Now, what he was not suggesting is that people go up and pick fights for the purpose of being punched twice. That's not the idea at all. What Jesus was telling people was, listen, rather than wanting to get revenge, you should prefer to be hit twice rather than get your own back. He was talking about an attitude of heart. You should love your enemies, Jesus said, so much that you would rather be punched twice by them than see them get punished. This is the attitude you're to have. You should not want to see your enemies hurt. You should want to see your enemies healed. You want your enemies to turn to God and be forgiven by them, and then you can be reconciled to each other. You should want your enemies to change so that you could be friends. Love your enemies. And Jesus pointed out that God sends sunshine and rain on the evil and the good, the righteous and the unrighteous. In other words, this planet's full of good things that everybody could enjoy, even though everyone has turned against God. So if God's got a loving attitude towards everyone, well then you should have a loving attitude too. You can go further then after, when Jesus dies and rises again, Christians realize that Jesus did not fight the people who came to arrest him. Now, one of his servants did, Peter. Peter drew a sword and tried to attack the men who were arresting Jesus. And Jesus stopped Peter and healed the man who Peter had struck in the ear. Peter, when he was confronted by Pilate, the governor who was sending him to death, said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight." In other words, I'm not here to start an armed revolution. So even though Jesus had done no wrong, even though Jesus was the Son of God, he was not calling for his servants to get even. He was not prepared to fight. He was not prepared to perform any miracle to save himself, to strike his enemies down. Jesus turned the other cheek to the extent of going to the cross. And he died and he rose again for his enemies. So one of the Roman centurions, one of the men who had arrested Jesus, watches him on the cross and says, surely this man was the Son of God. And that man gets forgiven because he realizes that Jesus is the Son of God dying for him, even though that man put him on the cross. Even though that man was part of the army that put Jesus on the cross, he can be forgiven. Jesus dies for the people who are putting him to death. So when you put all that together, you get a very powerful argument for saying, well, if I want to be like Jesus, I want to listen to what he said. I should turn the other cheek. I should love my enemies. I can look at the Old Testament commandment, do not murder. And Jesus didn't fight his enemies. And he said, if my kingdom is not of this world, if it were, my servants would fight. And you put all that together and you get to the idea of pacifism. Pacifism is about peace. You never fight. Now, there are absolute pacifists who will do nothing at all to help in wartime. There are other pacifists who will, say, join ambulance services, who will join the Red Cross, who will do everything that they can to help those in need of time of war. So there's two types of pacifists. There's absolute pacifists, and then there's pacifists who will join different organizations. They won't kill people, but they will help their country. So that's pacifism, which sounds fine. But what do you do, for example, in, say, Rwanda in the 1990s when the Hutu are annihilating the Tutsi people and they're killing them and they're putting them to death? Or what do you do in World War II when Hitler's invading other countries and one of his aims is to completely annihilate the Jewish people from the face of the earth? Should a Christian fight them? When Christians actually came to power, when Christians, they were persecuted for maybe the first 300 years of their existence on and off, they had a hard time, but eventually, after about 300 years, Christians came to be accepted, and very soon there were Christian emperors. And then you've got a problem. I'm in charge of a country, and somebody's doing something terrible, and the only thing I can do to help innocent people is to fight for them. So should I fight for them? Could a Christian be a police officer? Is it okay for a Christian to be a police officer and to use a gun and a truncheon to protect the innocent? Well, if it's okay for a Christian to be a police officer, well, surely a Christian can be a soldier and defend the innocent. Is it okay to defend innocent people? That's a big question that Christians have to ask. Those who say yes believe in something called just war. A just war. A just war is a war which has justice on its side. And a just war is a war that is fought out of love, in a loving way. Now, what that immediately tells you is that a lot of wars just will not count as just wars. If you go to war to make your country great, or if you go to war for revenge because it's been attacked, then that is not a just war. But if you go to war to protect innocent people who are being murdered, who are being persecuted, who are being destroyed by a ruthless enemy, well then maybe you can fight out of love. So a just war has to be fought to defend the innocent. There are other conditions. A just war can only be fought if you have tried everything else first. You must talk, you must plead, you must try everything possible other than going to war. You can never use more force than is necessary to stop the evil you are fighting. So you can never go well over the top in your attack. So if somebody is attacking a small town in your country, and they're hurting innocent people there, well, you can fight a just war in self-defense to protect yourself and to protect innocent people. But what you can't do is destroy that whole country completely, the country that's attacking you. You can only fight until the enemy stops. And then the fighting must cease. In a just war, you only fight enough to stop the evil. It's fought to prevent evil. It's not fought to destroy evil. Now that's really important. A just war is fought to prevent something evil happening. It is not fought to destroy evil. Because think about that from a Christian point of view. In Christianity, everyone's a sinner. If you're going to fight to destroy evil on earth, you'll have to kill every human being on earth. We are all capable of evil. So a just war is not fought to destroy evil. It is fought to protect innocent people, and only to protect innocent people. And once you have protected them, you stop. And you never do more harm than the evil you're fighting. And the simplest way of illustrating that is to say, well, if there was a terrorist in Armagh hiding somewhere in some building, you could maybe send in a SWAT team or a group of commandos to capture him, or maybe even to shoot him if he wouldn't surrender. But what you couldn't do is bomb Armagh and kill everyone in it just for the sake of getting that one terrorist. You have to keep things in proportion. Don't do more evil than the evil you're fighting. So those are the rules for a just war. There's also something else called a holy war. Now, holy wars, you can fight them in Islam. They're called jihad in Islam. And Christians at one stage fought holy wars that were called crusades. And the idea of a holy war is that it is different than a just war. Because in a just war, fighting is seen as sort of a necessary evil. It's a bad thing that has to happen to stop something worse happening. So a way of thinking of a just war is a bit like this. It's a bit like amputating a limb. Sometimes a doctor will look at somebody's limb. Imagine a doctor's out in the wild, there's been some sort of plane crash, and it's away out in the mountains or away out in the desert, and there's a person in the plane crash whose leg has got infected. And the doctor says, listen, I'm going to have to cut that leg off to save the rest of the body. It's not that cutting legs off generally is a terrible thing to do. You know, you don't cut people's legs off for fun. You don't cut people's legs off to make yourself feel good. So generally, if you went around cutting people's legs off, you will go to jail. But if you have to cut somebody's leg off to save their life because you're a doctor and you've tried everything else first, then that's okay. So sometimes it is okay to do something that would otherwise be bad if it prevents something terrible from happening. So that's the idea of a just war. A just war is like amputating a gangrenous leg. It's bad. You don't want to do it, but sometimes you have to. But in a holy war, the fighting is actually seen as something that's good. Fighting for God is good. It's not a bad thing that you're sort of halved or forced into. This is a great thing to do. This is a good thing to do. This shows your devotion to God. And in the Crusades, people actually went to war thinking, well, by being brave and sacrificing and going off to the Holy Land to free Jerusalem from the Muslims, I'm somehow doing a good thing that God likes. Now, the difficulty with holy war, they are extraordinarily dangerous things, because I think there are two forces at work in human hearts. One force wants people to do terrible things. We all, at the end of the day, if somebody insults us, if somebody makes us feel small, if somebody angers us, there's part of us that wants to get revenge, and more than revenge, that gets angry, that wants to really harm the people who get in our way and that annoy us. And really what holds us back is the consequences. We're afraid of what would happen if we were to hit everyone that annoyed us. We know we'd get in trouble. But there's part of us that wants to do terrible things. But then there's also a part of us that really wants to be viewed by others as good. We want other people to think that we're good and that we're nice people. And part of us just wants to be good. So we've got part of the human beings who sort of, you know, we want to appear good to our neighbours, we want to appear good to other people, we want to appear to be holy people, and we don't like it when others think we're bad. And then there's part of us that wants to do terrible things, that will get angry, that will get proud, and that will do terrible things to others. In a holy war, you get to do both at once. In a holy war, you get to kill other people and look holy at the same time. In a holy war, you get to kill other people and look like a good, holy person while you're doing it. And so holy war is a terribly dangerous thing. Christians simply can't participate in one. The Crusades are something that still embarrass Christians because people look at it and think, how on earth can you justify a crusade when you look at Jesus' teaching? When you look at Jesus' teaching about turning the other cheek and loving your enemies, how did anybody ever reach the conclusion that fighting for God could be a good thing? And by fighting for God, they don't mean being nice to your neighbour. They mean literally taking a sword and cutting people's heads off. How can slaughter be something that pleases God when you look at what Jesus taught about God? So holy wars can be terrible things because people are given an excuse to be murderous and look holy while they're doing it. There are different organisations that can help in time of war. One of the most important organisations is the Red Cross. If you look at the history of Rwanda, the genocide in Rwanda, which is shown in the film Hotel Rwanda, the International Red Cross at that stage was able to do a tremendous amount of good because they're neutral. They do not take anyone's side, and they will treat any wounded that come to them. So the International Red Cross, it also works within nations. There's a British Red Cross that works within Britain, but the International Red Cross, and in Muslim countries is called the Red Crescent. They can go in, they can help refugees. The International Red Cross was really the only international organisation that worked in Rwanda, but they did a tremendous amount of good and saved tens of thousands of lives. And because they were neutral, once somebody, for example, a Tutsi who was being hunted by the Hutu, and the Tutsi who was going to be killed by the Hutu, if they made it to a Red Cross camp, they were safe. Because the Red Cross actually threatened to pull out, told the Hutu, listen, if you continue to kill these people, we're pulling all our Red Cross workers out. And that means if one of your soldiers gets injured, there'll be nobody to help them. And so if you made it to a Red Cross camp, you were safe. And the Red Cross were able to get food and medicine through to many people who needed it. So the Red Cross is one group who helps. The other is the United Nations. The United Nations is basically like a parliament made up of all the representatives of the countries in the world. And the Red Cross sometimes send in peacekeepers. Now, peacekeepers are not peacemakers. Peacekeepers are not allowed to go around shooting people so that there's a peace. A peacekeeper is generally sent in to make sure that if two groups have agreed to disarm, they do disarm. In Rwanda, what happened is they sent in a group of peacekeepers who were meant to make sure that both sides, Hutu and Tutsi, were disarming. The agreement between the Hutu and the Tutsi fell apart, and then this horrible genocide happened. But because the peacekeepers were only there to try and make sure people were disarming, they did not have the authority to go around fighting people who were killing innocent Tutsi children. So the Hutu extremists who were murdering people weren't stopped. So one of the big questions about the UN is, what use is it if the countries who are in charge don't allow the soldiers to stop evildoers? So that's the whole issue of the UN and peacekeeping. The UN, though, can do an awful lot of good. The UN probably did save thousands of lives in Rwanda, and that is often forgotten. A lot of the peacekeepers who were there and who did help did so at great risk of their own lives, did so with very poor equipment in very poor conditions, and quite often simply had to talk to people who were heavily armed and talk them out of killing Tutsi who were under their protection. Finally, the last thing you need to know about are weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction are chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. The aim of a weapon of the mass destruction is to destroy a city, to destroy the innocent people living in a city. One of the things that you're not allowed to do in a just war is to kill somebody who cannot defend themselves. You're not allowed to fight children. You're not allowed to fight old people. You're not allowed to fight people who cannot fight back, who cannot defend themselves. The whole idea of a weapon of mass destruction is to kill those people. That's really all they're good for. Armies, because they're in tanks and helicopters, if they believe they're about to be targeted by a nuclear weapon, they can disperse, they can spread out over 10, 15 miles. Even the largest nuclear warhead's only going to be effective within a sort of a mile square radius, and that's the really large ones. Nuclear weapons are no use against armies, but they are devastating against cities. The whole point of a weapon of mass destruction is to kill innocent people. So the question then becomes, should a country be allowed to possess them? And Great Britain does. Great Britain has something called the Trident Program. And we have three submarines which travel around in the ocean undetected, and each carries, I think between them, something like 120 missiles, enough to destroy a small country. We use nuclear weapons to defend ourselves, and the question that we have to ask is, well, should we be allowed to do that?